Even though we've had a bit of friendly jousting from time to time. That's all we've got time for today. Indeed, all that we have time for at this time ever on the Petline programme. But do join me at 2.30 on Sundays and 2.30 on Tuesdays on the new station on 11.52. Until then, it's me, Bradley Viner, saying goodbye and keep well and handing you over the last time to Rob Byrne at the LBC Traffic Centre. Good morning, Rob.
Yes, thank you very much, Bradley. Good morning to you. Good morning, all. Well, if you're out on the capital's roads today, you can expect some delays still in Camden Town. The reason for that, Kentish Town Road is closed. That's between Hawley Road and Hawley Crescent. It's closed only for southbound traffic there. Also, Camden Street remains closed between Camden Road and Crowndale Road. And together, those closures cause a little bit of local congestion through there. Elsewhere, the A4 Tailgarth Road between Hammersmith Flyover and Glidden Road. If you're heading that way, you can expect delays. One lane's been taken out in each direction. The A406 Gunnersbury Avenue at the junction with Uxbridge Road. Some roadworks likely to slow you down through there today. Hammersmith Bridge, that's closed for maintenance work right across today. And in Knightsbridge, the A4 Brompton Road will be a little slow westbound. Some roadworks in place opposite the Harrods store. Public transport, one for the early birds on the District and Circle line. Buses run instead of trains between South Kensington and Embankment until 7.30.
On Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday, pick up any available car up to a mid-size for just £29.29 per day at your budget rent-a-car office inside the M25. Budget. Far and away a better decision.
Rob Byrne at the LBC Traffic Centre.
From October the 5th, will you be listening in black and white or colour?
They're laughing and they're crying and they're drinking
champagne. I'm Douglas Moffat. Throughout the weekdays, 24 hours a day, we'll be bringing you the latest finance and business news. With access to Reuters news bureaus around the world, we aim to be fastest with the financial news and, even more important, fastest with the interpretation and comment. Twice an hour, 24 hours a day, news from the main financial markets and what it means to Londoners.
London News, 97.3 FM. All news, all the time.
This month, Sainsbury's The Magazine has a distinctly Japanese flavour. Delia Smith explains the art of tempura, the classic Japanese dish of seafood and vegetables in a mouth-meltingly light batter. And Simon Hopkinson shows you how to make nasu dengaku, otherwise known as grilled aubergines with miso paste. Meanwhile, for those with a passion for traditional apple tart, Nigel Slater shows how to get the very best out of English Cox's and Bramley apples.
Every month, Sainsbury's The Magazine offers you a feast of ideas to help you enjoy the real sensual pleasure of food. If you love good food, you'll love Sainsbury's The Magazine. Out now, only 95 pence.
LBC News Talk, 97.3. News.
It's 7 o'clock. The sole British survivor in the Estonia ferry disaster has been spending his first night back at home. Paul Barney from Berkshire stayed alive for several hours when the vessel went down and tried to save other passengers in a lifeboat. Since then, faulty hydraulic doors have been discovered in three Finnish ferries. Mr. Barney attacked safety procedures as woefully inadequate.
How come that the Titanic, which was supposedly unsinkable in 1914, managed to go down in 4 hours? And a boat in 1994 went down in less than an hour with a higher proportion of loss of life.
A 58-year-old man's due to appear in court charged with the murder of the millionaire racehorse trainer Alex Scott. William Michael Clement O'Brien is also accused of threatening to kill another man. Mr. O'Brien is to go before magistrates in Cambridge tomorrow. Two young boys and a 12-year-old girl are among nine people injured when security guards and gunmen opened fire on a crowd in Haiti. Shooting began when people tried to raid a warehouse of food. An historic meeting between an Ulster unionist and the president of Sinn Féin, Gerry Adams, is due to take place later this week. Ken McGuinness has agreed to debate with Mr. Adams on American television, Jim Lumsden reports.
The two men are expected to square up to each other on Larry King Live on CNN. Loyalist politicians have previously refused to share a platform with Republicans, but must be concerned at the amount of coverage Mr. Adams' US trip is attracting. It remains to be seen whether this debate descends into the shouting match between Gerry Adams and ex-Ulster Minister Michael Mates, witnessed by millions on British TV earlier this week.
Labour's deputy leader John Prescott is warning of higher taxes for the rich if the party wins the next election. Mr. Prescott's comments are said to be at odds with those of leader Tony Blair. A former cavalry officer is claiming that he had a 3-year love affair with Princess Diana. Major James Hewitt says in a newspaper article that he and the princess were deeply in love and that she even contemplated leaving Charles. Buckingham Palace says it hasn't seen the newspaper and can't comment on the story. For Reuters Radio News, I'm Douglas Hardy.
Thank you, Douglas, and neither can we, but we can comment on the weather. Well, we won't. We have an expert, of course, at hand. And at the please.
Pardon me while I laugh.
Well, it's always seemed so to me. Out of that, you make a very good effort at it, Frank. It's Frank Green at the London Weather Centre. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Stu. I don't like the word expert. X is a has-been and a spurt is a drip under pressure. But, apart from that, the weather not too bad during daylight hours today. It's cloudy, a bit misty in the suburbs, even one or two patches of fog about as well. But the mist and fog will clear fairly readily, I think. It may brighten up a little bit now and again later this morning, but really I think it's going to be cloudy for much of the day. A bit warmer than yesterday, about 17, that's 63 Fahrenheit this afternoon, but a bit more wind as well. And I think by the end of the afternoon, quite a brisk southwesterly wind. Then this evening, the weather turning wet, and it'll be a wet evening and night. There'll be heavy rain and quite windy as well. I think the wind's still freshening up and a fairly strong southwesterly overnight. Temperature's not falling much, no lower than 13, that's 55 Fahrenheit. And then tomorrow, well, a wet start and still pretty windy as well. But I think in the afternoon it'll certainly brighten up, turn much colder, brighter as well, but much colder. May even be a touch of frost tomorrow night. Frank Green, London Weather Centre.
Thank you. Maybe you'd like to be a future spurt, therefore, would you, Frank? All right, hear from you again in an hour. Bye. Thanks bye. Very much, Ian. Jeez, bye-bye. Well, good morning, one and all, for the very last time on this radio station. Anyway, let me say welcome to the Steve Jones Breakfast Show between now and 10, all the top news stories of the day, plus the regular contributions from Patrick Keighley, Lawrence Spicer, Richard Robbins, and our team of round-the-world correspondents who'll be looking at child discipline. Do the kids get a smack on the bottomly in Russia, America and Japan? Well, the Labour Party conference gets underway in Blackpool, and while the local councillors fight over an unpaid electricity bill for the illuminations, we'll throw some light on what the delegates will be discussing with London MP Frank Dobson and our political staff, Ed Boyle. Ian Fenn forms a perfect embouchure to report on the brass band championships. We take a trip to Tenerife, and Liz Fraser joins us to sing the praises of John Le Mesurier and Arthur Lowe. As ever, it's busy as can be on the biggest, brightest breakfast show on the 3 days to go, Voice of London, LBC.
London, the 24-hour city in a 24-hour world. And now, 24-hour London News Radio, with its heart in the city, its finger on the international pulse. At 6 a.m. on October the 5th, London News, 97.3 FM, bringing you all the news, all the time. And more. All the sport from London's sharpest sporting team. Finance and business news, direct from our studios at Reuters, the world leaders in business information. London's most advanced weather technology, bringing precise, up-to-the-minute forecasts. The capital's first integrated traffic and travel service, around the clock. Authoritative, entertaining. London News, 97.3 FM. All news, all the time. Because that's how it happens.
Why is the Clever Map Company so clever? Because they bought Microsoft Office for Windows from Centerpoint Discount Software. And now Microsoft will be sending them an additional software package worth £100 absolutely free. If you buy Microsoft Office for Windows now, you too can choose one of 10 complimentary products, courtesy of Microsoft. So, put on your clever clogs and get down to Centerpoint Discount Software. They're next to Tottenham Court Road Tube, just behind the Centerpoint building. Or call 071 836 0599. It wouldn't be too clever to miss this offer.
This is the Steve Jones Breakfast Show.
Indeed, business as usual between now and ten, and good to have you company this early on. It's now 6 and a quarter minutes past seven. It is round two of the 1994 political party conference season, round three if you count the Scottish Nationalists. But of course, rosy cheeked Labour supporters are now heading for the mecca of frolics and fun, Blackpool. It's the first time that Tony Blair will take the platform as leader, and although his popularity in the polls may have slipped slightly of late, he and his party are still streets ahead of the Conservatives with Gallup, Murray and the rest. So will the faithful use this week to celebrate and laud the new king of Walworth Road? Or will it be straight down to business? A question I put to our political editor, Ed Boyle.
Oh, I think they'll get down to pretty serious business this week. They can't continue to strew roses at his feet all week long. The Labour Party ain't like that, Steve. It always calls itself a broad church, and that means it's got the breadth to include the left, and the left goes to conference in order to flex its muscle. Its muscle may not be quite as large as it used to be, but it's still there.
Yes, well, the left wing is going to have a great deal to say, I would think, therefore, about the modernisation, so-called, of the Labour Party under Mr Blair and Gordon Brown, who seemed to lay out what their economic policy was going to be this week. That's what he said he was doing anyway, but I couldn't understand a blind word of what he was going on about, actually.
Well, you could understand this amount, that he wanted to get away, they both want to get away from any public idea that the Labour Party means high taxation. But you're quite right, it didn't spell out any of the detail, and they're not really going to this week. What they're laying down is a kind of broad strategy. It's like a motorway plan. We'd like to put a motorway somewhere in the south of England, but we're not exactly going to tell you where, because all those little villages in the south of England would go bananas if we did. So you've got an element of uncertainty which is going to remain and is going to outlive this conference and will probably remain for the next year or so. They will drip, drip, drip detail in when they're sure of the detail. They're not yet sure of the detail, and that's the honest truth.
No, but surely those who are having I'm talking about the rank-and-file MPs now, the backbenchers who are having to knock on doors and meet constituents at weekly surgeries, need some answers, because if I come in to see you as my local Labour MP, I want to ask you face-to-face, how much tax am I going to be paying under your regime, and you've got to be able to tell me.
Well, have you? I mean, see, look at it from Blair's point of view. This young, charismatic leader. It has not been the problem in the past that politicians have said one thing and not been able to deliver. Here, so he would claim, as a politician who says nothing and can deliver nothing until he decides to deliver something specific. Yes, I agree, it sounds like a tall order to sell, but it is being done slowly, and whether they can hold the left wing in line and whether they can also garner support not only from the right wing, which they've got in their own party, but from the centre ground of British politics and from business in general as a whole. If they can do that, then they've pulled something off. But I quite agree with you. We all want detail, but it's crazy to ask for it too soon. In point of fact, Kenneth Clark would probably answer in exactly the same way if you asked him that question. We cannot make decisions about the day after tomorrow.
There is a danger, though, isn't there? Just sticking with the economy again for a moment, that if they continue to make these sort of nebulous statements about what might happen, the only sure thing being that the Labour Party under Tony Blair, and would have been also under John Smith if it comes to that, are more open to embracing the market economy than ever before.
Yes, in case of inevitabilities.
Well, this is true, but at the same time, if they become increasingly conservative, then the question has to be asked, why bother to vote for a party which doesn't really offer that much of an alternative?
You could argue it that way. You could also argue it that if they are more conservative, why vote conservative? We've had, 15 years of conservatives. Why not have some Labour conservatives?
OK, what else will they talk about? They won't concentrate on the economy. Law and order, I suppose, is bound to be a central issue.
They'll talk about law and order. They will talk about, the rows, and one tends to focus at rows, or at least journalists do, much to the chagrin of any political activists of any political party. The rows will centre on, should there be women candidates and women candidates only? Should there be this kind of positive discrimination? And there will be inevitable rows when it comes to the detail or the lack of detail on how we create jobs. Lots of ideals, but people want more than that down on the ground. But I would expect, despite that, that Blair will emerge nevertheless as the man they want to trust and the man in whom they are now pinning their hopes. If a party like this has lost, as it has the last four general elections, it doesn't want to go into the next one with an expectancy of losing it because they're divided. They will come out united, but of course, because it's Labour, they will grumble, they will grouse, they will carouse in the bars, they will make little headlines that don't make altogether good reading, and they will give meat for the Tory party, which gets together in Bournemouth for its conference the week after next. They will give them grounds to have a grumble at Labour. That's what the conference season is all about, I'm afraid.
And it's Labour's turn, as we were hearing there from Ed Boyle, as they gather in Blackpool a little later. In fact, I think in about an hour's time, I'll be talking to Frank Dobson, a London MP. It's now 11 and a half minutes past 7 o'clock, and you're listening to LBC, the Steve Jones Sunday Breakfast Show.
That's nice.
Oh, yes. Oh, my.
That's nice.
Now, Sunday Telegraph readers can lead more colourful lives.
Oh, that's lovely. That's nice.
Each issue has a coupon worth 50p off any one of a range of leading colour magazines. Vogue, House and Garden, Tatler, The World of Interiors, GQ, Vanity Fair, and The Spectator. The Sunday Telegraph. The Sunday that comes with a choice of colour.
The BT Business Forum this Sunday at noon, in association with BT Working for Business. Join me, Brian Widlake, for the business and economic news of the week, plus an expert panel analysing a main business topic of the day. That's the BT Business Forum with me, Brian Widlake, on Sunday from 12 until 1.
Well, many of the Top Talk team off to pastures new after today's programme, including young Funny Fenny, who, of course, has been reporting for us now for the past couple of years. So it's the last post for him today. And for his last report, we sent him to the National Brass Band Championships, which are currently being held at the Wembley Conference Centre. You could say, well, indeed he would say, that it's his final chance to blow his own trumpet.
There are 96 bands in the finals of this year's National Brass Band Championships. They've all successfully come through a number of regional heats, but contest coordinator Brian Hick believes the biggest challenge for a band is being able to survive.
The days are long since gone where a brass band could afford to turn out for a village fete or whatever for a small amount of money. The costs of equipping a band with the musical instruments now is astronomical, and when I would speak in terms of about £70,000 for a new set of instruments, I'm probably understating it.
But despite the cost considerations, brass bands are still very popular with both musicians and the public. Apparently this weekend Mr. Hicks has noticed people of all ages arriving through the Wembley Conference Centre doors.
The ages are very much more spread. One finds that a lot of the top bands have a lot more young players than they probably used to, and this is probably due to more emphasis placed on music in music colleges.
Among the judges for the competition are Betty Anderson and Sheila Tracy. They believe becoming Britain's best brass band comes down to musical interpretation, the ability to change tempo, and being able to produce thick sound rather than thin.
The art of underblowing but with a full, rich sound, I think, sums it up. In other words, you've got to have that beautiful, rounded sound even when you're playing pianissimo or fortissimo. So you mustn't blast when you're playing fortissimo, and you mustn't get all thin and weedy when you're playing pianissimo. So it's really a question of underblowing but still getting the full, rich sound.
Brass bands, it's quite easy to blow too hard. One or two bands today did blow too hard and the sound becomes very harsh, but the majority of them, we had some lovely sounds. Fourth section bands from all over the UK, but some of them had got some very promising, some very good potential bands there, no doubt about it.
Well, never one to miss the opportunity of showing off, I found my way along to the trade stand hosted by show organisers Boozy and Hawks. There I found Clive Guthrie with their latest model of cornet.
This is a traditional brass band instrument where in normal orchestras or big bands you would find a trumpet. This is a cornet, which is a more mature sounding instrument, and if you'd like me to give you a little demonstration, then maybe you could have a blow afterwards, see what you think.
You made it look very easy. Is it a difficult
you think
to play?
So?
I think so.
It isn't. It's forming the the embouchure muscles from the lips in the correct way to give an aperture to blow air through, at the same time making what would be described as a sort of raspberry sound.
Okay, well, I've never touched a cornet before, so how should I start? I mean, if you pass me the instrument.
Well, it's quite a comfortable, compact instrument to hold. So if you just take your hand and put it around the valve group section there,
yep.
Put your little finger in that hook there, and then these three fingers on the actual pistons, and then just try making that raspberry sound down the mouthpiece while you're pushing air through it, and see if you get a sound.
Marks out of 10?
Only one, I'm afraid.
So no good for this year's competition?
No, I think we better try again next year and you can go away and do some hard practice.
Well, I think I'll have another go just to see.
Remarkable progress. Is he having us on? Our man Ian Fenn there reporting from the National Brass Band Championships. They continue at the Wembley Conference Centre later today. You're listening to LBC. Steve Jones with you through till 10.
This is a DHL Worldwide Express time check.
Now, what a grand time check it is, too. It's 18 minutes past 7 o'clock.
DHL Worldwide Express for collections 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Well, time to get the old legs going now. We're going to take you on a walk, and we've chosen a rather exotic and unusual location to get you off the beaten track. The island of Tenerife is best known for its sun and sand, but it also boasts some excellent walks high in the mountain that dominates the island. Our reporter Mark DeLue, always one for a ramble, laced up his boots and took off for a trek in Tenerife.
Tenerife is the largest of the Canary Islands, situated in the Atlantic off the coast of West Africa. With average temperatures rarely dropping below 70 degrees Fahrenheit, it is of course a popular destination for many holidaymakers. But one feature of the island that's less taken for granted but growing in appeal is the opportunity it provides for walking enthusiasts who are after spectacular scenery. The reason it's so spectacular becomes clear as soon as you arrive, because towering over the small island is the giant peak of Mount Teide, which at just under 4,000 metres is nearly three times higher than Ben Nevis. And being a volcanic island, the variety of different plant life and rock formations keeps you guessing all the way. After taking an hour's bus ride from Puerto de la Cruz in the north of Tenerife, our guide Gregorio led us along some of the pine-strewn paths of the mountain area called Chanajiga. Gottfried, a keen walker in Tenerife, explained the appeal.
Everywhere on the island is ample opportunity to walk on smooth paths in the heights of about 1,500 meters. The clouds, the conditions of the sky, the sea, the colors of the sea are changing from hour to hour, so it's never boring to walk. Everybody knows that God threw Adam and Eve out of the paradise, and there is no reason why we shouldn't try to reconquer it from the back door. So Tenerife is a back door to the paradise.
As well as the pines of the laurel forest, the subtropical climate of Tenerife gives rise to a spectacular range of stunningly coloured flowers and palm trees. One of the island's most famous endemic species is the dragon tree, which features a rich plumage of long sword-like leaves and has a sap known as dragon's blood. Like many things in Tenerife, it's steeped in history. Lázaro Sánchez Pinto, curator of botany at Tenerife's Natural History Museum, explains why.
Dragon's blood, because it is from a red colour. And with this type, here can you see a little drop of dragon blood. It was used most of them as a toothpaste. As toothpaste, yes.
Really? Is it good for the teeth?
Oh, yes, fantastic. It is said that clean the teeth. Very good, no?
It doesn't leave them red. It's a red juice.
At first, yes, but after a few minutes, they became a white color. It is said that the Romans know the Canary Islands, and they used to transport dragon blood to Rome, where the woman used this power not only as a toothpaste but also in cosmetic in the eyes, no, for the to paint the eyes.
Romeo, I've been walking for about 3 hours in the forest area of Mount Teide, and I've come upon a spot here with a magnificent view. Behind me is the peak of Mount Teide. It's the highest peak in the whole of Spain, even beating the Pyrenees. And apparently it's snow-capped in winter, which seems all the more remarkable considering we're in a subtropical climate here. In front of me is a beautiful expanse of sea, and just beyond that is said to be the spot in the Atlantic Ocean where Nelson lost his arm. But I don't think we'll be looking for that today. And above me, flying above me, it looks like a kestrel or a sparrowhawk hovering at the moment, actually, no doubt trying to catch its next meal. At over 1,000 metres and having walked about 5 miles, I think it's fair to call the view here breathtaking.
The beauty of Mount Teide and its surrounding areas is undeniable, and to preserve it, the Teide National Park was created in 1954. One man who's particularly dedicated to preserving the environment and creating more walking opportunities for the enthusiast is Señor Enrique Talg. He owns the Hotel Tigaiga in Puerto de la Cruz, whose gardens with over 160 carefully nurtured plants and trees are a famous landmark. He's now set about a project to create dramatic new walks along the north coast of the island. He says Tenerife has a big advantage over other areas because, as well as the scenery, its small size means that it's impossible to get lost.
You are here in a valley and you can always see you are in another country, in the middle of the mountain, big mountains. And if there was a change, you can be in danger, but not here, because you know always that walking down, you can to the sea.
Señor Talg is also planning special routes for disabled and handicapped people. At the end of my day in the mountain, I asked fellow trekkers Jane and Michael what they thought of the walk.
Well, I was very surprised. I thought it was all, beaches, Tenerife, but these spectacular walks. Incredible scenery, pine forests, wonderful. And there's easy walks for for beginners, and then quite advanced for serious walkers.
And it's such a huge contrast to the place. As you go higher up, first you get into the pine forests, and higher than that is the volcanic area, and that's really like being on another planet. It's just incredible.
If you are planning a trip to Tenerife, the proximity of Mount Teide to the sea means it's worth packing your walking shoes along with your swimsuit. It's thirsty work, but with the local sangria in plentiful supply, it's well worth the exercise.
Mark DeLu walking around on Mount Teide, well, not Mount Teide, Mount Teide, on Tenerife. And as he says, the temperature in the Canaries, it's always brilliant. It was, 25 yesterday, and is set to be that for the rest of the week. Warm and bright, occasional sunshine too. And he was on that trip courtesy of Magic of Spain. You can get in contact with them on 0303 226602. It's now 25 minutes past 7 o'clock. It's LBC. Many people have watched, some with surprise, the furore over the conviction of the new Bishop of Durham in 1968. Senior church leaders were well aware of that conviction and have spoken of forgiveness. Our religious affairs correspondent Lauren Spicer now comments.
I wonder how many times, like me, during your life, you've been told that you must forgive and forget. And I wonder how many times you've been able to do one or indeed both of those things. You know, it's dreadfully easy for other people to say that to you. They don't have to struggle with the bitterness that you're feeling, to soothe and cover the wounds, to re-establish your dignity that you've lost, and to pretend that the physical loss or injury that you've sustained has gone. And yet all they're doing is re-emphasising the teachings in all the so-called good books of every faith. I talk about this not just because of the unfortunate revelations about the new Bishop of Durham, but because all over the world we're enjoining, from a lofty perspective, others to do just that. Take the instance of the Tutsi in Rwanda. Not 9 months ago, 500,000 of their number were brutally hacked to death by their tribal enemies in ways and circumstances that really are too terrible to imagine. The international world is commanding them now to forgive and forget. Well, they can't forget, that goes without saying. We know that they should forgive, but that, in reality, is rather too much to demand of people for whom such an overwhelming loss is so close. But I don't think that the demands are totally unreasonable. Forgiveness, there'll have to be. The problem is that time, which doesn't necessarily heal totally, that's where the forget bit is so impossible, is needed for the pains and the vivid memories to dull, if not heal, without leaving a scar. Secondly, you know, there's got to be real help in the processes. And that's why the reported inability of the United Nations to punish the main perpetrators of the crimes committed in Rwanda is so scandalous. Without that, and with the vision of those people going totally free, the Tutsi can hardly be expected to forgive. So there, you see, we've got two cases. First of all, a criminal act punished and long gone in 1968. Further retribution is called for by some people, many of them ministers in his own church. And don't let's forget that if he was to be forced to resign, that would be further punishment for him. Was not one punishment enough? Does he deserve that? Does the crime warrant it? Which brings me back to the teachings in the holy books on forgiveness. They don't differ at all, you know, whatever the faith. Punishment is there, but forgiveness is too. And forgiveness is the important element. And it is, as I've already said, the most difficult element. My own attitudes to this were changed some years back when I went to interview Dr. John Coleman and his wife, released and repatriated from wrongful imprisonment in Iran, 8 months of it. Didn't they feel better, I confidently asked the doctor. No, he replied. After all, we went to Tehran to ask for an extension of our work permits, and they gave us another 8 months. And then he went on to explain how negative bitterness is, above all to oneself. The object of your bitterness is eating and sleeping and enjoying him or herself, whilst you're all knotted and torn up over it all. Let it ride, he said. You'll feel the better for it. And in another way, you'll feel rather proud of yourself. I find that every time I feel full of revenge and bitterness nowadays, I think of those words. Dr. Coleman was right, you know. But, as with the Tutsi of Rwanda, I acknowledge the difficulty of achieving the equilibrium in oneself that would enable all of us to forgive totally.
The weekly comments there by our religious affairs correspondent, Lauren Spicer. Now we're heading for the LBC Traffic Centre. And I'm not quite sure who's there this morning. I think it's Rob Byrne. I hope so, because he's my old Aussie chum on a Sunday morning. Good morning to you, Rob.
Yes, good morning to you, Steve. Good to be back on a Sunday. A look at the roads today. Neasden A406 North Circular near the junction with Great Central Way. You can expect some westbound delays there because of roadworks and lane restrictions. In the east, Romford Road junction with the Grove. Once again, westbound delays likely because of lane restrictions and roadworks. Chiswick High Road junction, Turnham Green Terrace. We've got some gas works going on today. You'll find some delays there because of that. Also, Victoria Embankment likely to become slow underneath the Waterloo Bridge because of lane restrictions. That's affecting traffic both ways. Traffic lights out this morning. Camberwell New Road Junction, Kennington Park Road. That's opposite the Oval Tube Station. Also, Romford Road Junction with Green Street. Lights are also out there.
On Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday, pick up any available car up to a mid-size for just £29.29 per day at your budget rent-a-car office inside the M25. Budget. Far and away a better decision.
Rob Byrne at the LBC Traffic Centre.
That was a waft of paradise. It conjures up the sustained loveliness of a Barclays investment bond. Deposit a minimum of £2,000 and you'll gain a moderato of 6% gross in the first year, reaching a crescendo of 12% gross in the fifth. Music to your ears, listeners. Glissando to your local Barclays to arrange your notes in a 5-year investment bond. One look at your returns and you'll experience that tingling one gets listening to Debussy while sipping champers on the lawn.
Interest is payable gross to non-taxpayers. Interest rates quoted are for an annual interest option. All interest rates are fixed. For more information, visit your local branch or phone 0800 400 100.
LBC News Talk 97.3 News.
It's 7:30. I'm Douglas Hardy. The sole British survivor of the Estonia ferry disaster has spent his first night back at home. Paul Barney has criticised those responsible for the vessel, saying safety procedures were totally inadequate. An investigation following the disaster has found that three Finnish ferries have faulty doors. A 58-year-old man has been charged with the murder of millionaire racehorse trainer Alex Scott. William Michael Clement O'Brien is also accused of threatening to kill another man. Mr. O'Brien is due before magistrates in Cambridge tomorrow. Three young children are among the latest victims of violence in Haiti. Nine people, including two boys and a 12-year-old girl, were injured when gunmen opened fire on a crowd. The shooting began after an attempted raid on a warehouse of food. Labour's deputy leader John Prescott is warning of higher taxes for the rich if the party win the next election. Mr. Prescott's comments are said to be at odds with the position of party leader Tony Blair. London's weather this morning will be dry, but it'll be misty for a while. There'll also be a lot of cloud around. Even so, it should brighten up every now and then later on. This afternoon, staying dry as well. Temperatures around 17 Celsius, 63 Fahrenheit. The next news at 8 o'clock.
LBC News Talk, 97.3 FM.
That's new.
Oh, yes. Oh, my.
That's nice.
Now, Sunday Telegraph readers can lead more colourful lives.
Oh, that's lovely. That's nice.
Each issue has a coupon worth 50p off any one of a range of leading colour magazines. Vogue, House and Garden, Tatler, The World of Interiors, GQ, Vanity Fair, and The Spectator. The Sunday Telegraph. The Sunday that comes with a choice of colour.
The BT Business Forum this Sunday at noon in association with BT Working for Business. Join me, Brian Widlake, for the business and economic news of the week, plus an expert panel analysing a main business topic of the day. That's the BT Business Forum with me, Brian Widlake, on Sunday from 12 until 1.
Sport on the Steve Jones Breakfast Show.
Yes, indeed. And our man this morning, Johnny Gould. Good morning, Johnny.
It's a literally good morning to you, Steve.
How are you? I'm very well, thank you very much. No stopping Newcastle United, huh?
Certainly isn't, no. Still leading the way at the top of the Premiership this morning after beating Euro heroes Aston Villa 2-0. No surprise there, I suppose. Robert Lee and Andy Cole scoring the goals to maintain the Magpies' unbeaten run. Blackburn in second went down 2-1 at Norwich City. Manchester United remain fourth following their 2-0 win over Everton, but Liverpool go fifth after a mighty Steve McManaman hat-trick helping his club defeat Sheffield Wednesday 4-1. In London, John Solarco scored twice as Crystal Palace beat Arsenal 2-1, while Ozzy Odile's fortunes are improving slightly. Spurs won 2-1 at Wimbledon. Well, today, Chelsea, fresh from European Cup Winners' Cup success, play a derby against West Ham at Stamford Bridge. The Hammers languishing in the bottom four without the suspended Tony Cotty, with Chelsea's Dennis Wise in the same predicament. Chelsea central defender Ellen Johnson says, like all derby matches, it'll be hard fought.
They've had a bit of a difficult start, but that's going to be a really difficult one. Of course, it's a derby as well. So, but we need some points now, so we're just going there full of confidence. But that, you know, we know we can play and just have to keep playing like we do.
In boxing, Steve Robinson celebrating after retaining his WBO featherweight title in Cardiff last night. He beat London's Duke McKenzie after flooring his rival in the ninth round with a savage body punch. McKenzie was attempting a boxing record. He was attempting to become the first boxer to win world belts at four different weights. He's previously been the IBF flyweight, WBO bantam and super bantamweight champion. In rugby union, defending champions Bath are still leading National League One following their 15-10 defeat of Gloucester. The Quins are back on track, though, in London with a convincing home win over West Hartlepool. Quins England prop Jason Leonard says their opponents nearly took the honours, though.
We did let West Hartlepool back in the game, but in the last sort of 10-15 minutes, we did actually claw back ourselves. So at least that's another aspect that we improved on, where the last three games we played for 40 minutes and then gone to sleep for 40 minutes, where this time we only had a 20-minute spell. So we've still got to get rid of 20 minutes of letting the other side play.
The minutiae there of Jason Leonard, the Quins England prop, talking about yesterday's game. And two former Olympic champions, Rosa Mota and Olga Bondarenko, clash in this morning's Bupa Great Caledonian 10-kilometre run in Edinburgh. Mota, the 1988 Olympic champion, predicts that Bondarenko, the 1988 10,000 metres champion, will win. There's confidence for you. And Hartridge's Gary Staines defends his men's title against the former world marathon champion Douglas Wakihuri of Kenya, among another exciting field, which includes Scotland's leading distance star, Tommy Murray.
Thank you. Johnny Wacky Gould.
Enjoyed. Thank you so much, Steve.
Well, what about the racing yesterday? My mate's tips. Well, we went out because it was my mate's last tip for me anyway.
Oh, really?
And we had a third place in the 310. The Mercedes-Benz handicap.
That's not bad.
No, it was all right. That was a chase up at Chepstow. Nearco Bay, we got a third there. But I'm sorry to say that Ringmaster, his suggestion yesterday morning, although it did go to post as co-favourite...
It's still running.
No, well, I think it was fourth.
Oh, that's
it. Yeah, it was about fourth, but Halling with Frankie Dettori on board actually won it in a fine race indeed.
Mm.
It was excellent. So
excellent.
Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe at Longchamp today.
The big un.
Yes, it is. Well, Dettori is over there on a horse called Only Royal. Not sure whether to put money on that. In fact, my mate fancies King's Theatre over there
really?
Today. Yeah.
I've got absolutely no tips whatsoever. I put a needle in a newspaper.
It's the best way to do it.
And put it straight through the crossword. So, don't ask me.
All right. Did you draw blood on your finger?
Listen, if I'd have been any more inaccurate, I would have smashed my own window.
All right. Okay, see you in an hour, mate.
See you later.
Thanks. Johnny Gould there with the sport today. It's now 23 minutes to 8.
Intel reports from around the world.
Is it a bird? Is it a plane? No, it's the story of the businessman who can be in two places at once.
Well, it's quite simple, really. I had to be in London at the same time as I had to be in Chicago.
So, how did you get there and back? Private jet?
No, something faster than that.
It's amazing what you can do with a Pentium processor inside.
Mustache, I've got another video conference coming up on my PC with Sydney. Good day.
Right, stand by your beds. They're yours from just £49. Get those horrible backsides down to the furniture mill and try the three-piece suites from £299. Leather from £799. The furniture mill's open 7 days a week. Unit 5, Stevenson Street, Canning Town, by the flyover. 071-473-5533. I believe. Hey, much.
This is the Steve Jones Breakfast Show.
Nelson Mandela has arrived in New York for a one-week visit to the United States. It's his first trip since being elected to the South African presidency. Mandela's message to America is a simple one. Apartheid is gone. The sanctions have served their purpose, and now it's time to do business. Reporting for us this morning, here's Paul Woodley.
In contrast to previous visits, Nelson Mandela's arrival in New York yesterday was a low-key affair, but his week-long stay will be very busy. As well as addressing the UN's General Assembly, President Mandela will meet President Clinton and a number of other US government officials. But the real focus of this trip is not diplomatic, but business. The South African president is due to attend a whole series of luncheons and dinners with US business leaders, Wall Street types and managing directors. He wants to persuade them to invest in South Africa and trade with South Africa because that's vital to the country's rebirth. In the 4 years between when he was released from prison and the multi-race elections in April, Nelson Mandela urged US companies to study South Africa in anticipation of the time when the sanctions were lifted and they could make deals. Well, now he's following through on that. America had some of the strictest sanctions at city and state as well as at the national level, which means US companies have more to do in re-establishing contacts. But firms that were there before are going back in, and others are looking to South Africa for business for the first time. According to Bill Moses, senior analyst with the Investor Responsibility Research Center in Washington, an organization which looks for investment opportunities around the world.
In fact, we are seeing an increase in investment in South Africa, and I think that it doesn't happen overnight. I mean, people in America particularly, this isn't like Great Britain where there's been a long colonial relationship with South Africa and with Africa in general. People in America sort of see South Africa and see Rwanda. Now, they don't look at Atlanta and see Cuba or Haiti, but, you know, they don't picture that these are very different places. And that's another sort of issue that Mandela still probably has to work on for some businessmen, is that South Africa is a different country. That South Africa is a country where there's a commitment to democracy, the lights work, people stop at traffic signals, and you can do business, which is not the same as it is in many other African countries.
Bill Moses says Nelson Mandela does have a big advantage in America, a large reservoir of goodwill among the American people, including the business community, though there are concerns about his age, 76, and his health.
I think that a lot of American businesses are very impressed with Mandela as a man and as a leader of a government. I was speaking to the former head of one of the largest computer manufacturing firms in America recently, and he said that they'd always been very impressed with Mr. Buthelezi. And then during the negotiations, they were quite concerned about Mr. Buthelezi's commitment to democracy, and I think that was made even worse by his actions last week where he beat up a member of the Zulu royal family on television. But I think he said that Mandela is wonderful, and they do worry about succession. I think people who know South Africa a bit more realize that Mr. Mandela may be a once-in-a-lifetime or once-in-a-century leader, but that there is a pretty good second and third tier of leadership in South Africa. But, of course, they won't have the same name recognition and esteem that Mandela is held in.
Not only do U.S. business leaders hold Nelson Mandela in high esteem, but they like what he's done so far since coming to power, a very measured approach to reforming the South African economy. He's promised fiscal discipline and seems to be sticking to that. Nelson Mandela will start his visit by going to church later this morning with the former mayor of New York, David Dinkins, who was a strong opponent of apartheid. He'll meet the current New York mayor, Rudolph Giuliani, on Monday and also address the UN General Assembly before going to Washington on Tuesday.
Well, Paul Woodley there reporting on the arrival of Nelson Mandela in the United States for a brief visit of 1 week. The time now is 18 minutes to 8.
Inside Computers, this week on LBC. Brought to you in association with Intel. Amazing things start with an Intel Pentium processor-based PC.
Well, as you know, this is LBC Computer Week, and yesterday we were talking about using a PC at home and working from home as an office, and discovered, of course, that you can network all over the world, get into what I discovered were called bulletin boards, which can be found hither and thither. You can access the most amazing information, and very, very quickly, too. But, of course, PCs can be fun, and that's what we're going to concentrate on today: pleasure, leisure, and domestic use of your PC. And with me in the studio from PC Pro Magazine is James Tighe. Good morning to you, James. Very good to see you.
Good morning.
Now, you have brought a particular example of a very small Toshiba computer with you. But before we get into anything else, tell me what this machine is here that you've got with you.
Right. It's a colour notebook from Toshiba. It's actually their latest model. It's not in any way expensive or especially flash. It's really the sort of notebook that most executives are carrying around with them at the moment. It has a colour screen and sound capabilities built in, which, as you mentioned, we'll be demonstrating later.
Yeah, now, you say that we call this a notebook. That is, I suppose, it's a miniature version of the very large computers or PCs, isn't
it? That's right. It's probably not the sort of thing you'd find at home unless you had you were limited in space in a small apartment or flat. It does have the advantage, however, of you can type at home or work at home or play games at home, pick it up, play games on the tube if it grabs you, and move to the office and carry on working as you were at home.
Okay, well, we'll come back to this particular one and see what this can do in a moment or two. But you've got your PC at home, should we say. We talked yesterday about working there. Can this same PC also be fun?
It certainly can, yeah. Things have moved on a great deal from the early days of computing, where it was all text. Games, but it's not just games. There's a serious side. There's education with the children, or something that's called edutainment, which is combining the two, which is trying to make learning fun and interactive. You can do everything to playing movies on your PC if that grabs you too. So it is changing, and the PC is becoming more powerful as the market changes with it.
Now, the younger members of the family, of course, are going to leap onto any new technology and take to it like a duck to water immediately. Even the younger parents listening to us at the moment were probably not born into the computer generation. So how easy is it for them to become computer-friendly, or the computer be friendly towards them?
Right. There has been a big change in about the last 3 or 4 years, and that's called Windows. Windows is a software operating system which, instead of using obscure commands to perform action on the computer, actually uses little graphics, or what we call icons, to move files around, open files. So if you want, for instance, to play a movie, instead of typing in play movie or whatever the command may be, you just click with a mouse on the picture of a film strip and away it'll play. Mm. And that has made things a lot easier for people to get into computing, both at home and in the office.
James Tighe there from PC Pro Magazine. And the second piece we've done this weekend as part of our special Computer Week. It's now 7:45. And you're listening to LBC, the Steve Jones Breakfast Show. We're going to call up our guru, Patrick Keatley, after this.
Why is the Clever Map Company so clever? because they bought Microsoft Office for Windows from Centerpoint Discount Software. And now Microsoft will be sending them an additional software package worth £100 absolutely free. If you buy Microsoft Office for Windows now, you too can choose one of 10 complimentary products, courtesy of Microsoft. So, put on your clever clogs and get down to Centerpoint Discount Software. They're next to Tottenham Court Road Tube, just behind the Centerpoint building. Or call 071-836-0599. It wouldn't be too clever to miss this offer.
A bigger breakfast on the weekend with Steve Jones.
And Patrick Keighley is about to take us on another of our journeys from Whitehall to the world. Let me just remind you that Patrick's piece moves to a new slot in the coming week. You'll be able to hear him on Friday evenings, just after the 6 o'clock news on the medium wave band on 11:52. That's on London News Talk 11:52, after six on a Friday. But I'll remind you again of that later, after we've heard the thoughts of our guru for this weekend. So what's topical, you ask, and where are we going? Two questions which have propelled Patrick to stand back and take a perspective look at this world of ours, from Ireland to China and from Moscow to Mafeking. Here's our maestro.
Well, my friend, my thoughts this Sunday morning are not just topical about the Irish troubles and the travails of Tibetans facing Chinese guns in their mountain homeland, but long-range thoughts as well. In other words, the age-old friction between people of different races, which is generating this week's headlines over clashes in Bosnia and Moscow's ominous military moves along the frontiers of Chechnya. Thoughts you might classify not so much as topical as perpetual, even eternal. Is there some kind of wisdom to be distilled from all this? I would certainly hope so, because otherwise we might as well just throw up our hands and declare that the human race is hopeless, doomed to clash now and forever in a day, not just with words, but guns. I thought it might be useful in doing the last commentary in the Sunday morning series, before the switch to Friday evenings, to stand back from the immediate clashes and caterwaulings that defile our planet and see if there's any kind of basic principle at stake. Because that just might contain a clue as to how to reduce these clashes, avert future wars, and, in Shakespeare's words, pluck the flower of peace. At the United Nations, they keep a catalogue of all the armed conflicts in the world going on at any one time. When I was posted there as a correspondent, I used to drop in at the data processing office a couple of times a month. The dismaying thing was how, overall, the number never seemed to go below 20, sometimes up into the 40s. At the present moment, I believe the total is 27 wars at different points around the 6 continents and the 7 seas. But even that is progress in a sense. Before the UN set up the catalogue, the world community simply did not know how many conflicts were going on. So you'll ask, what does one learn by perusing the monthly roster about the causes of wars? Something truly significant, in my view, because it emerges that time and again, the thing that triggers human conflict is that primeval factor, race friction. Bosnia, at the present time, is the classic example. The victorious powers in the First World War, the Allies, decided in their wisdom to lump together a jumble of races living in the Balkans, up in the mountains and down by the shores of the Adriatic Sea, to give them a convenient name, the South Slavs, and declare them to be a nation, Yugoslavia. We are still paying the price for that ill-informed piece of statesmanship. Before coming to the microphone this weekend, I decided to make myself go into the whole thing from the year dot by spending a little time in the library at Chatham House, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, checking through the files and the reference books. I'll spare you the full rundown, except to say you'll find a clear, excellent account of it all in the Encyclopaedia Britannica Macro Edition. It takes some 2 dozen large pages in small print to set it all out, starting from the time when the Romans crossed the Adriatic Sea to the coast of Illyria. There they conquered the local tribe, the Dalmats, which is how we get the modern name for the region, Dalmatia. Then come the Slavs, driving westward through the mountains until their haphazard empire building is halted by the Adriatic waters. Some of the Slavs become members of the Orthodox Church, those are the Serbs. Some mix in with the Dalmats and become members of the Roman Church, giving us Croatia and Slovenia. And then you get clumps of people in smaller communities, Kosovo and Macedonia, speaking Albanian or Greek dialects, but still pronounced by the great powers in their wisdom who set up the deal to be part of Yugoslavia. As if these crisscrossings and mix-ups were not enough, you then have to bring in the invasion by the Turkish armies in the 1300s with a segment of the Christian Serbs becoming Mohammedans. Quite a community. By the time of the defeat of Turkey and the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, 5 centuries later, in World War I. So these are the so-called Muslims of Bosnia, actually Islamicized Slavs, and they're in the news now, day by day. So can you wonder that with the collapse of communism, which had been the glue sticking Yugoslavia together in the days of the Tito dictatorship, we have been watching the component communities going their separate ways or trying to. All around the world, there are clashing races, people divided from each other by religion, language, or ethnic origins. It is simply staggering how many of the wars, little or small, are rooted in this one basic factor, race friction. Just round the corner from Yugoslavia, so to speak, is the beautiful island of Cyprus, where the invading Turkish forces splashed ashore in the late 1400s, soon after the fall of Constantinople. Turk versus Greek, Islam versus Christianity, the troubles ebb and flow, but they have not been resolved from that day to this. Empire building seems to be the motivation in human beings that has led to these clashes down the centuries. The Russians had their troubles with the Mongol hordes, goodness knows, coming in and capturing and burning Moscow. But a couple of centuries later, there were the Russians committing the same imperial folly. Southward swept the armies of the Tsar into the lands of Asian Islamic peoples like the Azeris, Tajiks, Kazakhs, Uzbeks, and all the rest, not forgetting the Chechens, who I was talking about a couple of Sundays ago. Their little mountain country resisted so doggedly that the Tsar had finally to send in 350,000 troops, cavalry, foot soldiers, and artillery, before it could be subdued. And then, in September 1991, Chechnya declared itself independent again. In the past few days, there have been ominous movements of Russian troops along the frontier of Chechnya, where the line runs along foothill country, with President Yeltsin's defense minister, Marshal Grachov, arriving from Moscow to supervise what he describes as a military exercise. Empire building by China has led to the tragedy in Tibet, which begins to look like plain genocide. The Tibetans are utterly different in race, language, and history from the Han Chinese who run China. I know this from personal observation. They are deeply attached to their special form of the Buddhist religion, and now they, the Tibetans, have to watch the spectacle of organized immigration, which has already made their country 40% Chinese in terms of race. Guerrilla war is getting underway, organized by younger Tibetans. At the other end of the Himalayas is the beautiful Vale of Kashmir and the armed stalemate between India and Pakistan, which keeps flaring up in the headlines. Speaking as one who's traveled there, I can only say the contending forces see themselves as members of different races, though they look alike to the eye of an outsider like me. I have had similar difficulty in Sri Lanka, formerly Ceylon, where successive governments in Colombo have been trying to put down the Tamil uprising in the Jaffna Peninsula by the use of firepower. Even India got drawn in with troops in Rajiv Gandhi's day. I've spent much time in that beautiful island, traveling coast to coast, and like other visitors, I cannot tell a Sinhalese from a Tamil to look at. But they can, and that is the point. Another island, closer to home, presents the same problem, and I must say, one has to doubt the wisdom of a far-off pope who asked the English king, Henry II, to stage the original invasion. The pope was convinced that Christianity was in danger in Ireland and requested Henry to take a force of his Norman troops, including cavalry, to Dublin, Galway town, and the other main centres to build castles and protect the bishops. And then, in the reign of James I in the 1600s, came a mass settlement programme with London guilds providing money and expertise and renaming the town of Derry, Londonderry, while other migrants were recruited in Scotland to help populate Ireland and keep the Celtic Irish beyond the Pale. Capital P for that one. The Pale was literally a fortified wall, a paling around Dublin. I think we can say that that experiment in racial mixing did not work then and doesn't work now. What a pity that the supposed political solution in Ireland in the 1920s was actually a botched partition, with at least a third of the population in Ulster being Celts whose sympathies lay south of the border. A full catalogue of all the forced marriages between races around the world would obviously take in the tribes of Africa, from the Hutus and Tutsis of Rwanda to the British and Boers at Mafeking, not to mention the Zulus, the Matabele, and many more. What it seems to amount to is that just as a flock of white sheep will shun any black ones, we clever, talented members of the species Homo sapiens are simply no good at organizing a mixture of races within the frontiers of a single state. It may not be wise or tolerant or defensible, but it is a fact of life. Truces, peace treaties, and political settlements need to recognize it. That is the path of wisdom. And on that note, I'll end this Sunday series from Whitehall to the World. See you next Friday, early evening.
Thank you, Patrick. That's after the news at 6 o'clock on 11:52 London News Talk. It's now time to head for the LBC Traffic Centre. And it's Rob Byrne. Good morning, Rob.
Thanks, Steve. Very good morning once again. Kentish Town Road still closed for southbound traffic. That's between Hawley Road. The closure runs all the way down to Hawley Crescent. You can expect some local congestion around the Camden Town area because of that. Compounding that problem as well, Camden Street is closed from Camden Road. Once again, for southbound, well, it runs southbound only. You will find some extra traffic today using St Pancras Way as an alternate route through there. In the south, in Clapham, the A24 Clapham Common South Side Junction with the A205, the Avenue, some roadworks there, and lane restrictions affecting traffic both ways. A4 Tailgarth Road between the Hammersmith Flyover and Glidden Road, we've got lane restrictions both ways through there today. Hammersmith Bridge is closed until 9 p.m. this evening for some maintenance work. And we've got traffic lights out this morning, Camberwell New Road Junction, Kennington Park Road, that's opposite the Oval Tube Station, and Romford Road at the intersection with Green Street. The lights are also out there. Public transport on the South Eastern Line today. All services to and from Charing Cross are diverted to call and terminate at Cannon Street, or start and finish at Cannon Street. And on the South West Line, due to engineering work, service between Waterloo and Reading, Windsor and Eton Riverside are all being disrupted, with services starting at Clapham Junction instead of Waterloo Station.
This is it, the big one, the Business Computer Exhibition of the Year, and it starts Monday, September the 26th at Olympia. Business Computing 94. Don't miss it.
Rob Byrne at the LBC Traffic Centre.
Rob, thank you. Ulster unionist Ken McGuinness has decided to go to America to debate live with Gerry Adams on television over there on the Larry King Show. Why is he going? What does he hope to achieve? We'll find out when we talk to Mr. McGuinness after the news at 8. Stay with us.
Why trade from curtain store to curtain store when the curtain store can come right to your door?
The Paul Simon Curtain Mobile Showroom is packed full with a massive range of fabric samples. Enjoy our friendly measuring and estimating service completely free of charge in the comfort of your own home. Right now, all our curtain fabrics are reduced by a generous 20% discount.
Simply call on us to call on you on 081-472-2333. That's 081-472-2333.
The Paul Simon Curtain Mobile Showroom. The curtain store at your door. 081-472-2333.
Hello, I'm Sharma Pereira, and I'll be with you Friday to Sunday mornings from the 5th of October on 11:52 a.m. with
Frank Boff. From 6, we'll be tackling the great and the good on the stories of the day,
as well as getting your views on the matters that you care about.
And because London's the most vibrant city in the world, we'll be looking at everything you could be doing with your weekend,
plus all the issues that affect your lifestyle.
So, if you retune to 11:52 a.m, you can join us for breakfast Friday to Sunday.
And start your weekend in style.
LBC News Talk 97.3 News.
It's 8 o'clock. The sole British survivor in the Estonia ferry disaster has been spending his first night back at home. Paul Barney from Berkshire stayed alive for several hours when the vessel went down and tried to save other passengers in a lifeboat. Since then, faulty hydraulic doors have been discovered in 3 Finnish ferries. Mr. Barney has attacked safety procedures as woefully inadequate.
How come
that the Titanic, which was supposedly unsinkable in 1914, managed to go down in 4 hours. And a boat in 1994 went down in less than an hour, with a higher proportion of loss of life.
A Finnish vessel with remote control cameras has set off to try to film the wreck of the Estonia in the Baltic Sea. It's been delayed for 2 days because of bad weather. It'll take 6 hours to reach the site of the disaster, and it's hoped the pictures it takes will prove whether a faulty bow door was to blame for the ferry going down. Two more Indian states have ordered the closure of schools and colleges because of fears the plague may strike students. The relatively rich Punjab and Haryana states are also worried that students coming from other areas may bring in the infection. The Labour leader Tony Blair is bracing himself for a showdown with left-wingers at this week's party conference in Blackpool. A major rally later today will push for a high minimum wage and a commitment to traditional socialist values. But our political correspondent in Blackpool, Ed Boyle, says Mr. Blair will ride out the storm.
Blair will emerge, nevertheless, as the man they want to trust and the man in whom they are now pinning their hopes. If a party like this has lost, as it has the last four general elections, it doesn't want to go into the next one with an expectancy of losing it because they're divided.
A 58-year-old man is due to appear in court charged with the murder of the millionaire racehorse trainer Alex Scott. William Michael Clement O'Brien is also accused of threatening to kill another man. Mr. O'Brien is to go before magistrates in Cambridge tomorrow. For Reuters Radio News, I'm Douglas Hardy.
Douglas, thank you for that. We've got to catch up with what's happening on the weather front with Frank Green now, and we'd better make the most of this as well, because I understand that Frank, in fact, is going to retire to get the old green fingers going very soon. Is this true?
Not the green fingers, the golfing fingers.
Ah, so. Right. What are you off these days?
Oh. When I retire, I'll be off about 16, I hope.
Well, that's not bad.
See, I hope.
Yeah, I've been on 21 for years now, and I just can't get it down. Well, but I've got the opportunity to improve as well now, so I'll meet you on the first.
Well, I think so. That's a good idea.
No, actually, come to think of it, I'll meet you at the 19th.
I was going to say, let's skip the first 18. See how we get on.
Okay, what's happening weather-wise today?
It's not going to be too bad today. It's going to be dry, I think, for much of the day. A lot of cloud right through the day. Just a chance it may brighten up here and there, but really not much brightness, I don't think. So a cloudy day. Temperature's a bit up on yesterday's, about 17 this afternoon, that's 63 Fahrenheit. The wind freshening a wee bit as well. I think fairly brisk, I think, by the end of the afternoon. And by the end of the afternoon, there could be a few spots of rain about, but certainly turning wet this evening, and there'll be some heavy rain this evening, and some heavy rain overnight as well. And quite a windy night, a strong southwesterly wind. But temperature's not falling much, no lower than about 13, that's 55 Fahrenheit. And then wet and windy to begin with tomorrow, but I think later on in the morning, the wind turning northerly, the weather brightening up as well, but it's going to turn much colder when it brightens up, so it really will be a chilly afternoon tomorrow. Mostly dry, just one or two showers about, and a cold night tomorrow night, I think a touch of frost on the ground in the suburbs. Frank Green, London Weather Centre.
From October the 5th, will you be listening in black and white or colour? London News, 97.3 FM. News that covers the spectrum. Red.
We can change the course of our history and build.
Yellow.
From the lands of conscience and reform. From the ancient bastions of liberalism.
Blue.
I set no bounds to my ambition for this country or its
people. London News. 97.3 FM. All news, all the time. Because that's how it happens.
Why is the Clever Map Company so clever? Because they bought Microsoft Office for Windows from Centerpoint Discount Software. And now Microsoft will be sending them an additional software package worth £100 absolutely free. If you buy Microsoft Office for Windows now, you too can choose one of 10 complimentary products, courtesy of Microsoft. So, put on your clever clogs and get down to Centrepoint Discount Software. They're next to Tottenham Court Road Tube, just behind the Centrepoint building. Or call 071 836 0599. It wouldn't be too clever to miss this offer.
This is the Steve Jones Breakfast Show.
It is live and exclusive here on The Voice of London, LBC. We're with you on 11.52 and 97.3 this morning through until 10. Between 8.30 and 9, Richard Robbins will be dropping in with a look at the new classical music releases on compact disc. So we look forward to that, and he'll be live with us in that half hour. In the meantime, it's 5 and a half minutes past 8. Good morning if you have just joined us, and welcome on board. Stay with us through till 10 if you possibly can. Later today, Ulster Unionist MP Ken McGuinness is flying to the US to take part in a face-to-face TV debate with Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams. In the past, Loyalist politicians have refused to share platforms with the Republicans, and Mr. McGuinness is on the line now. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
So why the change of heart?
Well, it's a question of tactics, and one cannot really allow Mr. Adams a free run yet again on coast-to-coast television on the Larry King Live show. He needs to be confronted with the reality of the activities of Sinn Féin IRA, and that's exactly what I think, that's what the American public need. My party, the Ulster Unionist Party, has spent a great deal of resources and time and energy in talking to opinion formers and politicians in Washington. Now is the time, I believe, to let the American public know the truth about IRA Sinn Féin and to challenge some of the misrepresentations that Mr. Adams is making. We saw very clearly on the on UK television the other night the facade of the peacemaker dropping away when he was confronted with when Adams was confronted with Michael Mates. And I think the Americans have the right to see the same thing happen.
Isn't it a fact, though, that the opinion formers and those in power in Washington are far more important than the American people coast to coast? I mean, you can get your message across to them, but indeed, what do they have to say? What use do they have in the debate over the possible peace process?
The one thing that I think we both would agree is that at this day and age, even the island of Ireland is no longer an island. People throughout the democratic world, the free world, take an interest in what is going on. Everybody knows about the terrorism, and so they need to know the story behind the story. That's something that has generally not been available to Americans. There's a lot of misunderstanding, and we did have we still do have organizations like NORAD raising money for terrorists. Now, it's very important that the people know the real story, that they know how the IRA, even though temporarily they've stopped shooting and bombing, are smashing young bodies in with bricks and cement blocks and hurley sticks in order to impose their will on the community here. At this very moment, this is what's happening. It's important that they realise that that is the case.
Yes, of course. At the same time, of course, the loyalist violence still continues. There's been no announcement of any sort of ceasefire from the paramilitaries on that side. Shouldn't that be happening very soon?
Indeed, and a great deal of effort is being expended in trying to persuade loyalist paramilitaries that they should announce a permanent end to violence. That's what we want all terrorists to do here in Northern Ireland. There is no difference in death being inflicted by one side or the other. But at the moment, the American scene deals with IRA violence, which has been responsible for about 2,000 deaths out of a population of 1.5 million over the past 25 years. And I think when one puts that in American terms and multiplies it up to cover 280 million people, the enormity of the terror that we've had to face over that time will be brought home to the Americans, who might have a mythical concept of what the violence is about.
Of course, the ceasefire which was announced by Gerry Adams was to do with so-called military operations. These current reports of beatings and punishment attacks that you talk about could be seen, could they not, simply as crimes against the person as opposed to some sort of organised military activity?
It's a good question, but I don't think you believe that, and I certainly don't believe it. This is an illegal organization which has a mandate from, sadly, about 10% of the people in Northern Ireland, or around 2% of the people in Ireland as a whole, through violence, having a veto against the democratic processes that the people here, that the other 90 to 98% of the people want. Now, that is something that has to be faced up to. And you know that that is the reality. I know it's the reality. It's important that Americans realise that.
Now, you're going to debate with Gerry Adams on television, with Larry King, his glasses, his braces and everything else that we're aware of on CNN. There have been various delegations, of course, to the United States of late. The only person to have had a face-to-face meeting with the president, Mr. Clinton, so far, is John Hume from the SDLP. Gerry Adams would like to. He reckons that the British government is putting pressure on Washington to prevent that from happening. Do you think that's the case?
I couldn't possibly say whether or not that is the case. But let me say this, John Hume, whether one agrees or disagrees with his politics, I'm a unionist, John's a nationalist, but John Hume is a bona fide leader of a constitutional party, and I believe that if my party leader, Jim Molyneux, was able to be in Washington at this time, he would also have a meeting with President Clinton. But these people, Hume and Molyneux, represent between them 60-70% of the community in Northern Ireland. Mr. Adams is not elected. He represents 10% of this community. As I said, his organization has also fought elections in the Irish Republic, and overall they represent something around 2% or 2-point-something% of the people of Ireland. That's not the type of person that Mr. Clinton needs to see. It's not the type of person he usually sees. And indeed, Mr. Clinton didn't see me when I was over as part of the delegation. I did see the Vice President as a Westminster Member of Parliament with other colleagues on that delegation. We saw quite a few people in the White House, as well as the Vice President. We saw the President's advisor on the National Security Council. We saw the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, Peter Tarnoff. We saw a lot of very senior politicians. That is proper, that is normal. But Mr. Adams has not got a mandate in his own right. He is not elected to anybody.
But you feel at the moment, just briefly if you could, by going to take part in this debate on television here, that the unionist cause will be taken more on board at the moment because, presently, maybe there is a lot more sympathy for the Sinn Féin cause in the States at the moment.
Yes, but I think you answered that question yourself at the beginning of the programme when you said Mr. Adams wasn't getting a great show up until now. I think the Larry King Live show is a coup for him, but otherwise he has not been getting a big show. We have been meeting, the Ulster Unionists, we have been meeting the opinion formers and the most senior people in government. Mr. Adams has not.
Ken McGuinness, thank you for talking to us again this morning. Ulster Unionist MP Ken McGuinness flying to the US to take part in a face-to-face TV debate with Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams. You're listening to LBC, and it's the Steve Jones Breakfast Show.
That's nice.
Oh, yes. Oh, my.
That's nice.
Now, Sunday Telegraph readers can lead more colourful lives.
Oh, that's lovely. That's nice.
Each issue has a coupon worth 50p off any one of a range of leading colour magazines. Vogue, House and Garden, Tatler, The World of Interiors, GQ, Vanity Fair, and The Spectator. The Sunday Telegraph. The Sunday that comes with a choice of colour.
As we stand in the gateway of the next millennium, no other technological advancement has influenced the latter part of the 20th century quite so much as the computer. We work with them, we play with them, but have we mastered them? All this week on LBC, you'll get a fascinating insight into the real world of computers. From the latest in word processing to the development of the information superhighway. Inside Computers, this week on LBC. brought to you in association with Intel. Amazing things start with an Intel Pentium processor-based PC.
This is a DHL Worldwide Express time check.
Well, it's almost... Well, it's just gone, in fact, 8.15. Just gone 8.15. 10 seconds past that time.
DHL Worldwide Express for overnight delivery to New York.
Well, for the past couple of weeks, we sadly have not had the benefit of the presence of Roger Walker on the programme at the weekends because he's been busy doing other things, preparing for his new role on one of the two new stations. But while he rehearses for that today, I'm glad to say he's found the time to pop in. And indeed, he's brought with him one of his famous railway journeys. Good morning to you, Rog.
Good morning, Steve.
So where are you going to be in the new scheme of things here?
Well, I shall be on Saturday and Sunday afternoons. So next Saturday and next Sunday afternoon for the first time, I shall have, my own show. We'll be doing an hour on, an hour off with my colleague Havovi Todd.
Oh, right, right.
So I shall be on, it's all rather complicated, but I shall be on from 4 till 6 on a Saturday, then she's on from 6 to 8, mm-hmm. and then I'm back, you know, so for an hour. But
you go away and prepare a bit, anyway.
That's right, yes.
Yeah. This is all happening on the FM frequency 97.3, which is London News. Right, okay. Well, I'm very pleased for you for that.
Well, yes, I am, but although I'm very sad that, you know, our particular association will come to a temporary halt anyway. Yeah. I hope it's only temporary.
Well, indeed, yes, we haven't quite hit the buffers. We're maybe just slowing down, if I may use a railway analogy.
Indeed, yes.
Where is this trip that you're taking us on finally, then, on the Sunday Steve Jones Breakfast Show here on LBC?
Well, this is a journey I made a couple of weeks ago on the longest journey you can make, actually, on a British train without actually changing. And this is the Cornishman, which runs from Dundee to Penzance, which is 704 miles.
Good Lord, how long does that take?
It takes 12 hours and 15 minutes, actually. Mm-hmm. And on the day I took it was actually on time.
Oh, good. And it did have a corridor.
It had a corridor, yes.
You remember the days when there were compartments sometimes without the corridor.
That's right, you fell out, yes, if you had one too many.
Well, this is true, and if you had one too many, there'd be something else which would be worrying you over 7 hours and 15 minutes as well, I imagine. Buffet car and luxury all the way, though, presumably.
Well, indeed, yes, yes. I mean, you'll hear in the report there is this concept called Voyager, which is very good, because basically for an extra tenner on top of your ordinary standard ticket, you get basically three meals, snacks, tea and coffee till it's coming out of your ears.
Yeah.
Free newspaper.
Oh, terrific.
Know, the works.
Yeah, sounds nice. Like a wonderful journey. Thank you for all the railway reports that you brought us, of course, as well as the regular news and sport on Saturday and Sunday morning.
Well, it's all been my pleasure, because particularly the railway reports, because, yeah. I mean, like Brian Johnson used to say, it's a wonderful thing when you actually get paid for doing what you love anyway.
Well, this is true, and I must apologise to you that you haven't made sufficient money out of my mate and his tips.
Well, never mind.
Okay.
Can't have everything, can
you? All right, so we're all aboard, is it now? What do we hear first?
Well, you will hear, very, very originally, a whistle. AM, we're just leaving Dundee Station on the Cornishman to Penzance. 704 miles, and it's the longest journey that you can make on a British train without changing. The Cornishman is the flagship of intercity cross-country, a unique railway in Britain. Managing Director Chris Tibbetts.
We are the only train operating company in the UK that provides services from one end of the country to the other. That singles us out, and this train being Britain's longest journey every day of the week is the best example of that.
Cross-country is a family railway, bringing together families and friends. Senior buffet car steward Harry Martin loves playing uncle to the wide-eyed, excited children on board.
One of my favourite points is the kids. You've got the trolley, you speak to them, and that, you know, and I've got two or three drawings from kids to Harry. And, I mean, it's nice, it's nice.
Kids like Jack and Sophie. This is a very good train, isn't it? What do you like about it?
We can have chocolate chip cookies.
Are you going to have one too?
Yes, yeah, to share.
Good. So where are you going to today, actually?
Somerset.
Is that for your holidays?
Yes.
And who's there? Who's going to be there?
Our grandma.
Do you want me to bring some more coffee through for you?
Excellent.
Yeah, and talking about Grandma, cross country's intercity services cater for everyone, young and not quite so young.
Well, it's looks lovely. I'm going to enjoy it because I had my breakfast at 7 o'clock. So
you're having another one?
I'm having it, and I just had.
That lady was tucking into her Voyager breakfast. Now, Voyager is a package that's ideal for the long distance customer. An extra £10 buying service fit for a monarch. Chris Tibbetts.
You make a booking with us to travel from, say, Edinburgh down to Plymouth, and one price buys you a seat reservation, buys you your travel, buys you as much tea and coffee as you can drink, a square meal in the middle of the day, and snacks along the way as well, and the reassurance that somebody's there to look after every need that you've got.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The senior conductor speaking. We will be arriving at Edinburgh Waverley Station in a few minutes' time. This train was forward to
Penzance. The at-seat Voyager service, currently available on a number of long-distance trains, is one that Cross Country is keen to expand. It's provided by designated hosts and hostesses, who also have to take their turn in the buffet car. It's a long, grueling day, but hostess Sharon Robertson says life on Cross Country's intercity services is richly rewarding.
It's brilliant, it's a good job, it's well paid, you work with nice people, nice bosses, and you get to stay in nice hotels.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is your seat attendant. We shall shortly be arriving.
Cross Country, like other train operators, has been hit hard recently for reasons totally outside its control. But Chris Tibbetts says it's fighting back.
The effects of the dispute between Railtrack and RMT just hit our revenue very hard this summer. Impacted a lot of customers and caused a lot of inconvenience. So, deep breath time. We're off looking for opportunities to promote the network that we're running and to pretty aggressively address potential customers out there in the grey wide marketplace and say, come on, we've got something good going here. Come and have a go with us.
Senior conductor Dennis Howson says Cornishman customers are special and quick to appreciate his brand of Yorkshire humour.
Yesterday, for instance, I had a chappie who gave me two tickets, one for himself and his wife, and I just looked at the tickets and I said, yes, sir, there's one at that end of the coach and one at that. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, you are going to Loo, aren't you?
Many travellers make extremely long journeys, but Chris Tibbetts says Cross Country's intercity services have something for everyone.
We're in lots of different markets, starting at one end, I guess, of the business, but typically perhaps travelling from Sheffield into Birmingham or Bristol down to Plymouth, making trips of around about 100 miles or thereabouts. A lot of local commuting traffic on our big trains as well. We move a couple of hundred people into Edinburgh every day from Fife, for example, on the train you've travelled on. You may have seen some of those people. Children going to school in the southwest of England, and people making very long trips, Scotland down to the southwest, and so on.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Your senior conductor speaking. We shall shortly be arriving at Birmingham New Street.
As a matter of interest, I mean, I'm doing the journey in its entirety today, but then that's because I'm being paid to do it. Do many people actually do Dundee to Penzance in one go?
I think so. The answer would be surprisingly large numbers of people. I mean, one might hazard a guess that nobody would make a trip of that sort, but actually there are people who do, but in larger numbers, from places like Edinburgh down to Plymouth and to major centres in the southwest, like Truro and Penzance itself. And we probably typically would have somewhere between 20 and 30 people making a throughout journey from Edinburgh in well beyond Plymouth into the far southwest.
Meanwhile, as the Cornishman speeds deep into the West Country, senior steward Harry is still wisecracking with the customers.
All the women come up and hear the sexy voice. Well, of course, I like the sexy voice, but what about the face?
Ladies and gentlemen, your train, the Cornishman, will shortly arrive at Penzance, where it will terminate. We hope that you've
in this often prosaic age when we all take so much for granted, Chris Tibbetts' message is simple. There's still magic in trains.
Oh, I think they're enormous fun. I mean, as do most of the people, of all the people who work along with me. I mean, we have great fun actually producing this service. I think some of that rubs off on customers. I think customers' enthusiasm for what we do rubs off on us as well. So, yeah, there's a lot of romance about the thing. It is unique, and it's, well, back to it. It's great fun.
Roger Walker there, on the longest single rail trip you can take in this country. Thank you, Roger, for all of that. I didn't know that Mark Deleuze's brother worked for British Rail as well. It's 25 minutes past 8 o'clock, and this is LBC. Eurotunnel, we're still with the railways now. The company which offers the Channel Tunnel, or rather operates the Channel Tunnel, claims that the recent problems of water seepage have been cured. It was like unblocking drains, they say. They're now set to carry cars and their passengers from Folkestone to Calais, starting tomorrow. Initially, the service will be offered to shareholders only. They need a bit of special treatment, as the company is paying an astounding £2 million a day in interest charges. By mid-November, Le Shuttle is scheduled to be available to all, and later the trains running directly from Waterloo to Paris shall be ready for business. The Queen and President Mitterrand opened the tunnel officially in May, and that was a delayed ceremony. In fact, the whole project, it has to be said, an amazing feat of engineering, has been dogged by delays since the first borehole was drilled, right up to the present day. Even earlier this year, ticket holders had their money refunded, a point I put to our transport correspondent, Paul Maurice.
It's been a stop-start process for the last 2 years, really, hasn't it? I mean, nobody seems to know when it will officially start. They do say next Monday. Will it be put off again? That's one of the questions you've got to ask, simply because it has been put off month after month. But for the last 6 months, it seems there have been some teething problems, both with the trains, my understanding is, and indeed with the tunnel itself. But at last, Le Shuttle, carrying cars. It has, of course, carried lorries before, but carrying cars will start out across the channel. Let's hope that it goes with the sort of smoothness that the owners of it say that they need it to do in order to provide them with a commercial living, because there's a lot of money riding on it.
I still don't know exactly what the prices are, because when the tunnel was first mentioned, I wrote off a prospectus. I must say I haven't received one as yet. They did say that something would arrive in the post, but I still don't know how much it would cost me to go from A to B and back again, or from Folkestone to Calais and back again.
Steve, I've not got a price list in front of me, but they have been published, and they are sort of winter, summer, autumn and spring prices there as well. And of course, they are a great deal higher, in fact two or three times higher in some cases than the cheapest ferry fares, and indeed they are higher than the airfares as well, the lowest airfares. So it will be the most expensive way, but it probably will end up being the quickest way across the channel.
They must have lost an awful lot of money during the summer, of course, having not been able to take the holiday makers packages this year.
I suppose they have lost a lot of money, but if you think of the lifetime of that tunnel, which I think is about 50 years, then let's face it, a few months lost shouldn't do them any harm. That is, of course, supposing that the system will stand up to 50 years of constant use. And although they're only just starting the fare-paying car shuttle service, and very soon fare-paying Eurostar services, eventually, of course, trains will come from all over the country, and you'll get the same sort of situation as you get at the Shinkansen in Japan, with the bullet trains running every 15 minutes throughout the whole of the system. Now, that's the sort of job that you're going to get eventually. The trains will slot in, I think, even faster than that. You'll get them down to 10 minutes or even 7 minutes apart as they shoot through the tunnel at 150 miles an hour. Now, of course, that will bring enormous amounts of money to the tunnel operators during that time. You know, a train carrying 300 passengers at what is a very high sum. That you only have to work out the figures on paper, and you'll see that in a day, if everything goes properly, they'll make an enormous amount of money.
Yes, of course, those Eurostar trains setting out from the Waterloo terminus now will have to trundle across Kent, or relatively trundle, but nevertheless, it's still going to be 3 hours station to station from London to Paris, and that's when, of course, the main competition, I imagine, begins to take place, and it's between the railways, the tunnel, and the airlines then, isn't it?
Yes, I think it will be. I think most people will opt for either the airlines or the trains at that stage. The actual time lag between them, and if you take the London City Airport, which is perhaps closest, even that will be slower than the shuttle out of Waterloo to Paris or Brussels or Amsterdam, simply because of the time it's going to take you to get to the airport. I mean, you know what it's like getting to the airport. In fact, from Hammersmith, it can take you an hour or so. And then you've got to check in and get on the airplane. You've got to be there 2 hours behind. It's a nonsense. Eurostar, the shuttle, should be a great deal quicker.
Transport correspondent Paul Maurice, that was. And talking of transport, these links are written. It's Rob Byrne at the LBC Traffic Centre. Good morning.
Thanks very much, Steve. In West London, that's expected to be very busy today. A couple of reasons for that. Shepherd's Bush Road, there's lane restrictions there operating between Sterndale Road and Brook Green. Further south, Shepherd's Bush Road junction with Hammersmith Road, some gas works in today, and as a result of that, road width reduced. So Shepherd's Bush Road gets very narrow down around the junction with Hammersmith Road. And Knightsbridge Junction, Hyde Park Corner, a crane operating running until 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. That's going to cause some problems, primarily for eastbound traffic through there. And Victoria Embankment underneath Waterloo Bridge, some lane restrictions slowing traffic both ways. And Marylebone Road westbound, that's down to one lane from around the junction with Gloucester Place. Some tree pruning in operation there today. And from around about 9:30, 10 o'clock this morning, things will start to slow there.
Give your clients that feel-good feeling. Fly them to France in your own private aircraft for lunch, champagne or a day's golf and tie up that elusive deal. Call SFC Air Taxis now on 081 504 3000.
Rob Byrne at the LBC Traffic Centre.
Intel reports from around the world.
Last night, Albert Einstein, one of the greatest thinkers of all time, addressed a gathering of the entire Jones family from Walsall.
I thought he was brilliant.
I thought his theory of relativity was very interesting.
And what about you, Johnny?
Well, I thought you should have his hair cut.
It's amazing what you can do with a Pentium processor inside.
After seeing Einstein, we had a meeting with Martin Luther King.
LBC News Talk, 97.3. News.
It's 8:30. I'm Douglas Hardy.